13-20-287-CR and 13-20-288-CR, ex parte KJ.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court and counsel for the state, we're here today on early COVID era pretrial bond writ cases. My client, Krishan, has been incarcerated on a motion to revoke probation and two new felony matters since February 21st of 2020. Under Article 17.151 of the Code of Criminal Procedures, 90-day rule, he became entitled to a PR bond on the two new felonies on May 21st of 2020. Although this is outside the record, since briefing, he has had a surety bond set in the revocation matter. As to the aggravated assault case, at the time of the hearing, the state asserted that there are 120 days to indict Krishan hadn't yet passed. The state was relying on the McLennan County local standing order as authority for being permitted an extra 30 days to indict Krishan. However, the local standing order did not authorize an extension of Article 17.151 for May grand jurors. And still, as we stand here talking about these cases today, Krishan still has not been indicted on the aggravated assault case. As to the other case, he was indicted by a Zoom grand jury on May 6th of 2020. That is a grand jury that was composed of half live grand jurors and half Zoom grand jurors. He was re-indicted, as the state has called it, on May 26, 2020 by a proper live quorum. And this was 5 days after his statutory 90 days was up. Our position is that because he was not indicted by a proper quorum, the May 6th indictment was void and the state cannot be ready on a void instrument. Therefore, he was lawfully indicted on May 26, 2020, which is 5 days after his 90 days was up. Within our primary argument, we've also made several constitutional challenges to the Supreme Court's 12th emergency order, the McLennan County local standing order that was heavily relied on, as well as executive order GA-13. Before I get to the substance of the argument, I would like to take the opportunity to make a small correction to my brief. On page 32, I stated that as Gibson told the trial court in argument, ex parte Broski is a speedy trial case, not a 17.151 case. As the state's brief pointed out, I said that inartfully, and so I'd like to take a moment to correct that. What that should say is that the reasoning in ex parte Broski is entirely based on speedy trial cases. And in fact, the footnote in one of the cases that I will discuss shortly talks about how speedy trial cases are instructive in Article 17.151 cases, but there appears to be no case law that I could find that requires adherence to that body of cases. And in our brief, we suggest that there does have to be some distinction to recognize the remedy between a speedy trial violation and the remedy for an Article 17.151 situation like we have here. And so I would like to begin my argument by making the court aware of two new cases that it should find instructive as it decides this case that have come up since briefing. The first is Ex parte Tucker, which is an unpublished December 2020 opinion out of the Austin Court of Appeals dealing with an Article 17.151 issue like we have here. The second is Lira versus State, which is an unpublished March 2021 opinion out of Eastland, which deals with the parameters of what the 17th emergency order could and could not modify or suspend. And it invokes the CCA case in State Ex Rel Aug and that important discussion regarding procedural versus substantive rights in the context of a defendant who was forced to plead guilty over Zoom, over his objection. So I'll start by discussing the Tucker case. So this is a bond case where defendant's third issue was that he was not released within the statutory 90 days. And the case was reversed on that basis. And so I'll give the court a brief overview of the relevant facts. This defendant's case on June 1st, 8 days after his detention began, the state filed a motion to modify the Article 17.151 deadline, arguing that the emergency order in place at the time, which was the 17th, gave it the authority to do so. So I'll take a moment here and talk about how that differs from the procedure in Krishan.
Remind me again, what time period are we talking about on this Tucker case where he's being held bond?
90 days, ma'am.
Okay. No, but so, when was he, what time was he being held? I did not read the case.
The time he was being held in terms of when he filed for relief or how long he was held before he got relief?
When was he eligible for relief? I guess would be the correct.
He had argued that he was eligible for relief under the statutory 90 days. And the state came in and said, we couldn't get you indicted on time. We're filing a motion pursuant to the authority in the emergency orders asking for an extension. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And so previously, so I'll start back just so we have sequence good. So case starts on June 1st. 8 days after his detention began, the state files a motion to modify the 90-day rule, arguing that the emergency orders gave it the authority to do so. So I'll just pause again. The difference between the Tucker situation and our situation is the state did not file a motion. What we had in our case, what's called the McLennan County Local Standing Order. So both felony district court judges entered a standing order that said, the statutory period by which the state typically has to indict a defendant on a felony, which we all know is 90 days, is extended to 120. So in Tucker, the state asked. In Krishan's case, the court had a standing order, and the state relied on that standing order. Previously, in Tucker, on March 23rd and 24th, the state had arranged for the meeting of three grand juries, but did not present Tucker's case. On June 3rd, Tucker files his writ 90 days after his detention began. After a hearing on the state's motion to modify the deadline, the trial court granted the state a 1 week extension. The state's position was that their ability to extend the deadline under the emergency orders was merely asking the court to modify a deadline and was not a suspension of the statute, which is what Tucker argued, that it was a suspension of the statute. There was a follow-up hearing on June 11th, which is 3 days after Tucker had finally been indicted, at which he re-urged his motion for a PR bond. But at that time, the trial court concluded that the issue was moot since he had been indicted and denied him relief, and the appeal followed. And there are two important holdings in Tucker that I think apply here. The first is the Austin court concluded that the deadline in Article 17.151, Section 1, Subsection 1, may not be extended by subsection 22.035B of the government code, and that the state may not rely on an extension of that expired deadline to continue detaining a defendant in jail when the state is not ready for trial and is unable to announce ready for trial because it has not secured an indictment. And Tucker further states that the state failed to show that a defendant's pre-indictment jail detention is part of any court proceeding contemplated by the government code. And further, that no explanation was offered to address how this section authorized modifications or suspensions to procedure for court proceedings applying to pre-indictment jail detention, which is what we have here. And the Austin court said it was unpersuaded that it does so. And we've made a similar argument on page 11 of our brief, and that's regarding a grand jury not being a court proceeding and therefore arguing that the government code does not apply. The state's response to that, to our position, was that we only cited federal cases to stand for that assertion. But the court can see on page 12 of our 0288 brief, we did in fact cite to Texas law. We've cited a 2016 El Paso case that stated the grand jury belongs to no branch of government, but rather serves as a kind of buffer or referee between the government and the people. And we also cited to the Texas Practice Guide, as well as two CCA cases. I see I'm running out of time, but I'll talk about Lira real quick. Lira is the Eastland case that just came down a couple weeks ago. And in that case, they were operating under the 17th emergency orders. And the Eastland court reversed the trial court who forced a defendant to appear by Zoom for a plea, relying on the emergency order. And the court held that a defendant in a criminal case cannot be required to appear via video conference over his objection. And the court talks about this idea of what the emergency order can and can't do, and it distinguishes between procedural and substantive rights and says that a defendant's desire to appear live is a substantive right, not a procedural right that can be modified or suspended by the emergency order. And that's really what we have here. We've got a procedural right that was violated and could not have been modified by the emergency order. And so Lyra is very instructive and on point. We are talking about a different—
But aren't you making the argument that the grand jury has to be present and not the defendant? So how does that— I have not read these two cases, and I'm just going on what you're arguing with us this morning, Ms. Freud. But it would seem to me that it's quite distinguishable that we allow the defendant to be here in person, as opposed to what your argument is that the grand jury has to appear in person. How is that the same?
Yes, ma'am. And so we're talking about the initiation of a criminal case. And our Constitution says that we need to have a quorum of at least 9 grand jurors appear in a grand jury room. And Chapter 20 of our code talks about all the rules and procedures around the grand jury process. And that has always been construed as in-person attendance. It has always been construed that way. If somebody wants to tell me we've seen a case pre-COVID where a grand jury did not meet all in person in one room, I desperately need to read it. Please educate me, but I do not believe that situation has ever previously occurred. And so we're talking about a constitutional right to be indicted by a quorum, and that was absent here. He was not indicted by a live quorum that is required by
Constitution. Is there any case law out there that says that the grand jury all must be present, physically present in one room? I know that before COVID, we were never going to find a case because we didn't live in the world that we live now by Zoom. But I didn't foresee anywhere that we've all made the assumption that the statute said we all had to be in person. But I didn't see anywhere any case cited that stated that the grand jury must physically be in the same room.
And you're correct, ma'am, that there is no case. Our brief discusses the statutory, the construction of it, which is it has always been construed this way. In person in attendance has always been construed as being physically present, as well as the statute also discusses the concept of a grand jury room. And so in order for that to be construed literally as written, it has always been construed as requiring in-person appearance in a single room. And we not only here did not have in-person appearance, we also had two rooms when you think about it. We're multiple rooms. We've got a Zoom room and then we've got where everybody else may have been. So we have a violation both of the statute and we've also got a violation of the quorum requirement. And so I see I'm running out of time, so I will reserve my remainder for rebuttal unless there's any further questions I can answer.
Any questions? All right, Ms. Freud, we will let Mr. Price proceed forward.
May it please the court. I want to start off with the first issue that was not addressed by appellant in their brief, and that's the pending motion to revoke. The DePaz case, which was specifically relied on by the trial court, and that's a Austin case out of 2016, held that a pending motion to revoke in which the time frame under back then was 4212, now 42A, of the 20-day requirement for a hearing after a motion has been filed, constituted another allegation, which was an exception to the release under 17.151. More recently, the Tyler Court of Appeals in December held the exact same thing in Ex Parte Hall. And in there, they held that a pending motion to revoke would prohibit release under automatic release under 17.151. And in this case, it's undisputed that the appellant is being held on a motion to revoke, that no motion has been filed to have the hearing within 20 days. Additionally, because appellant did not raise or challenge that independent ground on appeal, that is a sufficient way to affirm the trial court's denial. And this court has held that back in Sandoval, and that seems to be kind of the seminal case on having to raise all issues on appeal, challenging the trial court's ruling. Additionally, the Waco Court of Appeals, which is a transfer case from, also held the same thing in State v. Avilas, and then they relied on this court's decision in McCain v. State. So because appellant did not challenge at the trial court level, did not challenge it in either of the briefs on appeal, that independent basis, which I believe are findings 24 through 27 of the court's findings in each case, supply a basis for affirming the trial court's decision. And then under the doctrines of judicial restraint and constitutional avoidance, I think it would be prudent to decide the case under that ground first, because that's a non-constitutional ground to affirm the trial court's decision, and therefore it would be unnecessary for this court to rule on any of the constitutional arguments being made. And both the Court of Criminal Appeals and the Texas Supreme Court has held that if the case can be decided on non-constitutional grounds, the appellate court should rule on those and not reach the constitutional issues. So that would be the state's first argument as to why this should be affirmed. Then it's to kind of separate these two cases out. There are two additional points for each case that appellant is relying on. The first one, which I'm calling the ex parte Broski issue, is the state's readiness even on a void indictment. And that's only applicable to the case for which there was an indictment, and that's the 288 appellate number. And the remote grand jury issue is only applicable to that as well, because the again, there's only an indictment in cause number 288. The modification of the deadline under 17.151, the standing order, and then the executive order, which suspended 17.151 by Governor Abbott, was only raised in cause number 287, the unfiled aggravated assault case. So going back to 288, ex parte Broski relied on not just Behrend and speedy trial cases, it also relied on Ward, and Ward was a specific case from the Court of Criminal Appeals that overruled the requirement that the El Paso Court of Appeals set out in Carahan that said that there must be a valid charging instrument under 17.151. And Ward went back and said, they took that from our case in Pate. They misunderstood our holding in Pate. To that extent, Carahan is overruled. So they specifically ruled that the requirement of a valid indictment is not required for the state to show readiness. And the Waco Court of Appeals and other Court of Appeals have relied on the concept of readiness under speedy trial 32A02 to apply to 17.151. And that makes sense because they all came about at the same time, the same legislation. So when the legislature is using the same words and the same phrasing in both statutes, they should be interpreted the same. The 10th Court has also relied on ex parte Broski, Behrend, and Ward to determine the concept of readiness. So under cause number 288, the state's reliance on the indictment return on May 6, which was within the 90 days, would be valid. There was no bad faith. The state was relying on the emergency orders out of the Texas Supreme Court and the order of the district judge, which allowed members of the grand jury to appear remotely. Moving on to the more substantive issue of the remote grand jury, there, and I think Justice Benavides hit it right on the head, there's no case that ever says that a grand jury has to meet in person. There's no authority for that under the case law. Now, in different types of proceedings, in different situations where we think of a requirement of face-to-face communication or face-to-face confrontation, the confrontation clause in Craig v. Maryland, the U.S. Supreme Court held that although it's the preferred method for confrontation, it's not required in all circumstances if there is a good, valid policy reason. And Craig v. Maryland is dealing with child victims testifying and having the inability to testify. So although historically face-to-face has always been preferred, it is not mandated or required by the Constitution. That was also held in the 10th Court of Appeals in Clay v. State, which is a Fourth Amendment case dealing with search warrants and telephonic search warrants. And in Clay v. State, they said there's nothing in the Fourth Amendment or Article 1801 that required a face-to-face swearing in front of the magistrate, they recognized that the Supreme
Court. But what are we doing now that we're, those cases were all, you know, post-COVID. And so now we're in COVID and we have cases, even though I haven't read the Lira versus State case, what are we to do now in circumstances that we were in and still continue to be in? And when we have cases like Lira that does say, if the defendant wants to have it all appear in person, they need to appear in person.
I think, and I've read Lira and Tucker, and really importantly is the Ex rel. Aug case, which the Court of Criminal Appeals outlined the difference between procedural and procedure and deadlines versus substantive rights. If we're talking about a grand jury meeting, I don't think that's a substantive right of the defendant. I think the physical presence is not the same of the grand jury is not the same as the physical presence of a defendant in court. When we talk about Tucker, I think Tucker is distinguishable. First, the problem with the standing order in Tucker was that it was entered after the 90 or the order in that case was entered after the 90-day deadline had expired. In this case, the order was entered before the 90-day deadline expired. So if you read Tucker, it actually says there's no, the state points to no authority that says the deadline under 17.151 after has expired can then be extended. So I think that's a distinguishing factor. Dealing with whether it's a court proceeding, I think Tucker misread Green, the concurrence in Green, which is what they relied on. In Green, they were talking about what constitutes a criminal proceeding under the critical stage that requires an attorney. And there they're talking about the initial appearance. And they held that the initial appearance is not part of the criminal prosecution, but I think a court proceeding is broader than that. So I think Tucker just got that part wrong.
So you think that they misinterpreted the Green case in the Tucker case. Is that what you just told me?
Yes, they relied on the concurrence. I believe it was Judge Cochran's concurrence in Green for the discussion about whether a criminal proceeding can occur or what the critical stage is in the fact that a initial appearance in front of a magistrate is not a criminal proceeding, but they did not rule that that was not a court proceeding in Green. So I think they misinterpreted Green a little bit. So I would distinguish that. Also, it's unclear as to in Tucker as to what the issues were raised of whether the 17.151 itself was a court proceeding, whether that was specifically challenged or not. Here, I don't believe in reading the briefing or at trial, the appellant specifically argued or raised the fact that 17.151 in and of itself was a court proceeding. They raised, I will concede that they raised the grand jury is, their argument is not a court proceeding, although the state disagrees with that under the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Adone, which specifically held that the grand jury is an arm of the court and it was not a separate independent grand jury is the cases that talk about federal grand juries. The Grainville case, which was a state case, but it was referring to a federal grand jury, not a state grand jury. So I think we've interpreted our grand jury system a little bit differently than the federal system here. But I think that's important to kind of recognize those distinctions. And then on the issue of the governor's executive order, which suspended 17.151, that was not challenged in cause number 287. It's only challenged in cause number 288. But the legislature has set up under chapter 418, a way for emergencies to be dealt with quickly, efficiently, and for the safety of the citizens of Texas. I think in trying to basically abolish the governor's power under a disaster declaration is dangerous. To require the legislature to meet to change any kind of rules or procedures or suspend any rules or statutes runs afoul of public policy when things such as, we had the ice storm a month ago. That was a very, very immediate event that you can't have the legislature come in from all over the state to do this. You need some sort of procedure set up. And the legislature has set very strict guidelines of when the governor can do this, how long the deadline is, 30 days. and has the ability to come in and cancel the executive order or the disaster declaration at any point. So they've remained control over the governor's authority. So it's not a violation of separation of powers because they still regain that control over the process. So I think I would urge this court specifically, going back to, I guess, the grand jury issue as well, I wanted to point out, when we're talking about the definition of quorum, appellant seems to have to add additional language in order to talk, to make it a how many people are present. The quorum is just the number. It's just a mathematical number of how many grand jurors have to be there, and it's 9. When we're talking about what the definition of quorum is, it's defined in the government code for the Open Meetings Act as just simply a majority of a governmental body, unless defined differently by applicable law. So trying to graft on an additional requirement to the word quorum to try to somehow imply a required presence, I don't think is what the definition of quorum would be under the Texas Constitution. It's merely just defining the number of grand jurors that need to be there. So I would urge this court really to rule first on the issue regarding the pending motion to revoke as being the exception to 17.151. And since that's been specifically waived by not being raised in the appeal by appellant, that has not been preserved by appellant at all. And then second, I'd ask the court to then move on to the ex parte Broski issue, as that's not a constitutional claim. That's another non-constitutional issue. And then only if both of those are not convincing to this court, then move on to the constitutionality of the grand jury meeting requirements, the modification of 17.151 by the trial court, and then finally the executive order by Governor Abbott. And if there are no more questions, I'd be happy to surrender the rest of my time back.
I do not have any questions, Justice Tejerina and Longoria.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Ms. Freud, I guess you need to start off on whether that he was being held on a motion to revoke is an exception to Article 17. And if we go that way, we don't get to any of your other issues.
Yes, ma'am. Here's why I don't lose on the other allegation issue. So Mr. Price is correct. Finding 27 on page 36 of the clerk record does rely on ex parte de pause. I will note that that is, although the findings do not say that, that is also an unpublished opinion out of Austin. And in that, it talks about the ex parte Shaw case, which is a Fort Worth case. And our position would be the same that was taken in ex parte Shaw, which is that each unindicted charge must be viewed independently, and being held on an indicted charge or revocation does not impact whether a defendant is entitled to release on the unindicted charge. And I'll look at specifically on page 4 of DePaz when it's distinguishing and saying why it's not going to follow Shaw. I think it fits into the reason why it should apply here. And on page 4, it says, we find the Shaw case factually distinguishable because it did not involve a hold based on a pending motion to adjudicate in a different county, but the indictment of another offense, and the defendant in that case did not contend that he was entitled to release on the indicted charge. And here we do contend that he is entitled to release on both an unindicted charge and then an eventually indicted charge. And so we would rely on the Shaw case for why we don't lose on the other allegation. Again, DePaz is a unpublished opinion out of Austin. It is not binding on this court. And so the court has flexibility with how it wants to evaluate the other allegation rule. And then as to if the court has no more questions as to why I don't lose on that, I was going to lastly address.
Where was Shaw out of? What court?
Fort Worth. And I've got a site for you if you need it.
Yes, please. Go ahead. Just so I can write it on my notes and not have to go back and look for it. Thank you, Ms.
Yes, yes, ma'am. 2012. I'll give you the Westlaw site. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it's perfect. 2012 Westlaw.
6632926. TxAt Fort Worth. December 21st, 2012. And then it was
there's a little bit of a complicated citation. It also went up to the court, the CCA, but on a different issue. But that should be the citation that addresses the other allegation.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And so I'll end with talking about why the state can't be ready on a void indictment. In our brief, specifically pages 18 and 33, we talk about the established case law that stands for an indictment presented by other than a quorum is a nullity and confers no jurisdiction on the trial court. And again, we cited Vance, Rouse, and Cook to support that proposition. And that's on page 33 of our brief. But when we just think about it, practically speaking, if the state can be ready for 17-151 purposes on a void indictment, the state can theoretically never be in a position to miss a 90-day deadline, because then they can throw however few people, or there's even one case out there where it was too many. There was a 13 in a room when there's only allowed to be 12, but too few people in a room or two rooms, multiple rooms like we have here, and return a void indictment, but still say they're going to be ready for trial. But if the whole point of 17-151 is to ensure that a defendant is not indefinitely detained while the state is not ready to go to trial, then Article 17.151 would lose its purpose. And so that's where I think the court has an opportunity to talk about why there needs to be some distinction between the speedy trial cases and Article 17.151 cases, because they're just different, right? The remedy for a speedy trial violation is going to be a dismissal. The remedy for a not indicting somebody within 90 days has no bearing on the state's ability to prosecute the case. It's just saying, let me out of jail. So that's what I think is really important when we're going back and we're talking about this heavy reliance on the speedy trial cases. And Barron relied on the old Speedy Trial Act, which was found unconstitutional. And so I think that that's really important. There has to be a distinction, because we can't be talking about bond relief and comparing that to the remedy the state, a defendant gets if he says his speedy trial right has been violated. And so the state should not be able to be ready for trial on a void indictment. And for these reasons, we would ask that our requested relief be granted, and we would surrender our remaining 2 minutes back to the court if there are no further questions.
I have nothing further.
Nothing further.
Nothing.
Okay, well then we will stand at recess, and this case is under submission.